Thanks. Thanks very much. That's great. I want to thank Paul for helping set this up. I'm so pleased to be back here. Thanks, Sean, too, for those poems. This is my fifth visit now to Cork. Hard to believe. And Anne's with me this time. Every time we come here, we get lost. We haven't got lost yet, but we're not home yet. So I mean, you know, I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch. I also have to just mention John Ennis, who plays such a huge part in the connection between Newfoundland and this part of the world, Cork and Waterford and Wexford. You know, I think John's retiring at the end of next year, and I am too. And my concern is, I just hope there's going to be people that are going to be able to carry this on, because it's just a marvelous connection that we have. Certainly, from our point of view in Newfoundland, we love this. This is so important to us. I hope this is going to continue. The other thing I was going to say is that Leanne and Andrew are going to leave in a few minutes. I just wanted to let you know before they do that, they're not leaving because they don't like the poems. They're leaving because they want to go home. That's all. They have to go home.
We changed our minds
after. Oh! All right. That's great. Well, as I say, I'm pleased to be here. I came primarily to read at the Canadian Embassy, to launch this book at the Canadian Embassy. It did come out this year. But I could not just come Ireland and knock them down to Cork and Waterford. It just would seem downright rude, so I'm really happy to be here. It is a book about, I'll say, ice hockey. I don't say that easily. I would never talk to my friends about ice hockey, because they would say, well, are you English or something? You know, if you call it ice hockey, you don't know anything about the game. But to us, it's hockey, and it's our lifeblood, you know, typically Canadian, we don't mind losing too much. We hate losing to the fucking Russians. I'll tell you that. This has just ruined my next 6 months. And to lose in overtime to them, you know. You guys can't understand this, because you're winning everything right now. You know, it's just, you forget the pain of losing, and this is tough. Anyhow, this guy, Terry Sawchuk, first generation Canadian, Ukrainian background, grew up in the north end of Winnipeg, is the greatest goaltender that's played in the game of hockey. I mean, which would make him one of the great athletes of the world. Living the Canadian dream. The story is so ironic. He played 21 years. No one had ever been able to handle this job for longer than 11 before him. You know, we all, one of the things that John did for me was ask me to read the hockey poems here in Ireland. And I said, well, I'm going to read it. Hockey poems in Ireland, to read them in the hurling counties. And I've been absolutely struck by the contact, the connections that people make between these things. John also saved my neck once, because he took me to see the statue of Christie ring the first time I landed here, and I've seen two hurling matches since. And I was up in Kilkenny, and I was about to start talking about how wonderful Christie ring was. John said, don't do that. Well, there's sharks in the water, and you just don't know where they are. Sawchuk was, I mean, the greatest of all. 16,000 shots he took, you know. The reason that I'm so struck with him is not just because he was green, but he was living at a time, I think, in the 50s and 60s, when the game was at its height. It was also a time of transition. Those guys were playing without masks. Nobody wore helmets at the time. Standing in against a 100-mile-an-hour slap shot without a mask, I mean, when you think about it now, you know, what kind of courage did this take? And he was also an innovator of the game. He was the one that introduced the crouch. He was very athletic. Goaltenders up to that point, there were a lot of Europeans used to play goal because they were good athletes, but they didn't skate well, so they would get put in goal and they would do a credible job. Sawchuk was a great athlete who skated well. He was really the first who could do that. And so he pioneered the low crouch, face down, trying to find the puck in the scrambles, you know, and it was extremely dangerous. 400 stitches to his face. God knows how many teeth he lost. The backs of both hands skated over, eyeball flashed, you know, I mean, it was unbelievable, and you know, it took its toll on him. I mean, he had a terrible family life, He became an alcoholic. The end of his career, it was shambles, really. And, you know, the subtitle I had for this book was the Long Career and Short Life of Terry Sawchuk. He died at the age of 40 in a fight with a friend as a result of drinking. And the quarrel, this is one of the saddest things, the quarrel, they were living together, actually, during the season. The quarrel was over housekeeping. You know, it's the great Canadian dream, and that's what you end up, you know, losing your life over. It's a sad story. He won all kinds of awards, but the story is really sad from the beginning. The book is about all goalies, maybe in all sports. I mean, I have some sense of what goalies in hurling or soccer would face. You know, the terrible pressures that goaltenders face. People keep saying to me, how can you write, you know, why a book about hockey and torture? Well, you know, my quick answer to that was Beowulf, you know, the Iliad, you know, Cuchulain, the myth. I mean, that's really, we're dealing with the same kinds of things. But I don't think I could have written a book about forwards, goal scoring. Defenders are a whole different thing. That's what I'm beginning to realize. Their lives are much more subtle. Their world is much more complex. The expectations that we have of them are greater. And when they make mistakes, we're much harder on them. You see forwards, you know, miss an open net in overtime, and they hold their heads, and then they go, everybody forgets about it. A goalie makes a mistake, it rolls across the line, well, in Colombia, or they shoot them. I mean, you know, it's just a whole different world. So, you know, they're just dealing with the pressure of letting the team down, the pressures of disappointing the fans. I don't think people, my brother played professional in the 70s, defenseman. I don't think people understand what it's like to have 17,000. That's the crowd you get out of hockey. Like, suppose in Pro Park, what do you get, 60,000 people?
80.
Whether you can imagine what it must be like to have 80 people screaming at you, wanting your blood, you know? Imagine if they took somebody from the artistic community and put them in that situation, you know, what it would be like. I mean, that's another thing that they have to deal with. But so there's all these pressures, and I think with hockey, you've got the added pressure of injury. It's just so prominent, the skate blade, the sticks, and that sort of thing. So, I didn't set out to write a book about a guy of courage. It's just such a compelling story, but I guess it kind of came out that way. The first poem I'm going to read, at this point, I always hear my daughters with my only daughters. The only woman I'm afraid of other than Anne is my older daughter, who said, Dad, don't talk so much, read the poems. So I'm going to read the poem. It's called One of You. There's a preface to this section. There's a section in the book on all goaltenders. And it comes from, actually, a catcher from baseball, the name of Jeff Torborg. Catchers and goalies have a lot in common. Not just the love of the gear, but just the injury factor. And Torborg once said, I thought this was brilliant, there must be some reason why we're the only ones facing the other way. I mean, isn't that incredible? I mean, just the sense of irony of it. Defenders have a sense of irony. Forwards don't even understand what irony is all about, you know. That's why they don't hang around together. One of you. Catchers in baseball. Closest to cousins in your differentness. The safeguarding home, the healing bones, the serious gear, which ought to indicate the possibilities, and only one of you. Denied the leap and dash up the ice, what goalies know is side to side, an inwardness of monk and spell. They scrape, they sweep, their eyes are elsewhere as they contemplate their narrow place. Like saints, they pray for nothing, which brings grace. Off days, what they want is space. They sit apart in bars, they know the length of streets in 20 cities, but it's their saving sense of irony that further isolates them as it saves. Percy H. LeSueur, for one, in a fitful sleep, flinching at rising shots in a bad light, rubbers flung out of the crowd, insults in two languages. Finally got out of his bed in a moment of bleak insight, went down and burnt a motto onto his stick, Hec est manus quae ictum deflitit. This is the hand that turns away the blow. or Lauren Shabbat in 1928. When someone asked him why he always took the trouble to shave before a game, angled out a leg to check a strap, and answered in a quiet voice, "I stitch better when my skin is smooth." Or dapper Charlie Rayner, who stopped a bullet with his chin, another couple of teeth, and some hasty work to close an ugly cut. Back the next night, he takes another full in the face. A second night in a row, he's down, spitting bits of tooth to the ice. "It's a wonder," he mutters, "why somebody doesn't get hurt in this game." Well, that's three goalies spanning, you know, over 60 years. Let's go dancing. You might recognize the song in the background. This is Terry Sawchuk. On the cover, he's playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Toronto Maple Leafs would be the equivalent in hockey of the Manchester United in terms of being the most valuable franchise. They have not won the Stanley Cup since 1967. Toronto is going to berserk over this. When I was in Toronto, I enjoyed holding up the book and saying, "You should buy this book, even if you don't like the poems. I just want you to see what a Stanley Cup winning goaltender wearing a Toronto Maple Leaf sweater looks like." They didn't appreciate this that much. So. Anyhow, I see him as a Detroit goalie. That's where he played his greatest hockey. I don't know if you know Detroit. Detroit kind of emerges. Detroit is a dangerous city. There's still a lot of rubble around the downtown core from the riots back in the 60s, 50s and 60s, and that kind of emerges in this poem. Just a couple of names. A lot of the names I've used with the players, you don't really need to know them. I'll mention maybe when DeFort and Lefty is the trainer of the Detroit Red Wings. Glenn Hall is one of the five great goalies of all time. Happened to be coming behind Sawchuk in the Detroit system, which puts on a certain amount of pressure. Poem's called "Let's Go Dancing." Watson, at 2:10 then, shot like a crowbar, Sawchuk speaking. "Let's fly from the top of the circle. Somehow I lose it, take one full in the mouth. Jesus. Spitting bits of tooth and blood. Lefty's out through the gate in a flash, so I know it's not good news. Here's the worst of it. You're sick to death of the life and worried over your job, and Lefty says, what bad luck, we just sent Hall back down to Edmonton." The clinic and its dread utensils, the clatter and pans, blood by the door, not mine. "Some woman out in Grand River," the doctor says. "They wouldn't let go of her purse. She wouldn't let go of her purse, so he slashes her face, the son of a bitch." Hums to himself as he thumbs back my lip and murmurs, "Getting to be a nasty neighborhood." Hums the same tune as last time, stitching my lip. I count five on the inside. 7-0 is 12, thinking, what's that song? "Forget the freezing," I tell him, thinking of Lumley the night when they tossed me over his sweater. First snow and fall, he's gone with the birds. Jesus, no, forget the freezing. 20 minutes tops, I skate back into the roar and hammering feet of the crowd. They love me tonight, the shits. And I'm standing on my head out there. I stop everything they throw at me but one. A minute to go, the crowd's up again and gone crazy, and wouldn't you know, I even remember the song. Is that all there is, my friend? Oh, I won't be dancing tonight. No ice-cold beer, no inch-thick steak for me to celebrate. Still, I'm the one with the grin. Big enough gap for a truck, as Gordy says, laughing. And Hall back in Edmonton, freezing his ass. My brother went up in 1971 with the Blackhawks. He's been a really important person in this book. I mean, I know the game of hockey, but I don't know the professional game. I mean, my brother is very observant, very quiet, and just saw everything that went around. And over the years, you know, the stories kind of accumulated. This is a poem called Guys Like Pete Bowiegan. In this book, I was interested in the game at the time and our country at the time. And I'm also looking at, I think, maybe even the role of sport in society. But this particular poem kind of gives you a sense of the Canadian manner. We don't like hot dogging. We don't like the guys that strut around in the end zone pounding their chest after they make a tackle. We are uncomfortable with the guys that rip off their shirts when they score a goal. There used to be a guy who scored in hockey. He'd ride his hockey stick around the ice. He did that twice. That was the end of it. The other thing is, this poem, I think, you know, there's a lot of humor in hockey, and but it's very kind of hidden, and a lot of it's self-deprecating. It's just, I think that's a very Canadian sort of thing. The other thing I want to say about this poem is that I think this is the case with all athletes. Surely you guys saw that with Munster this week. The players, you know, in the paper we read about the scoring, you know, who's got the most goals and all that kind of stuff. And it's important. You need to have your skill guys. You need to score goals. You need to win. But the players have a whole different hierarchy. What they are respecting is the toughness. That's what means so much to them. The kind of thing my brother was able to talk to me about was like what the guys would talk about on the bus. And you, as a Canadian, you would never embarrass somebody by saying, "That was a brilliant goal. God, that was really sweet. You look so good when you scored." You would never humiliate somebody by saying that sort of thing. And I picked up an epigraph of this poem from Hemingway, from Movable Feast. "We still went under the system then that praise to the face was open disgrace." Guys like Pete Bowiegan, sent out by Adams to settle a score, get something going. Throwbacks to Jack's own day. Jack is coach of the Red Wings. Throwbacks to Jack's own day when bleeding you'd swing by the bench for a swipe with a sponge. The clouding bucket, an emblem of pride in a simpler time. Players with slicked down hair hurrying back and forth along the boards. Pete Goegan. His name would come up years later, mentioned by Walt McKechnie on the bus. The golden seals on a terrible slide. Another collapse at the end. The seats in the dark slowly filling. Guys bandaged and beat and deflated, but shifting over to share a seat. Careful not to mention the good move or save or giving up the body for the team. The voices down in the back are subdued. The talk of the nose rearranged. A glove slapped in the face of a disliked opponent. You hear the quiet approving laughter. The talk down the old road. Old debts erased. The scraps and skirmishes. Pacings of mythological proportion. Toughest of the tough. The blood in the bucket still at the game's true heart. The smaller guys, the skill guys and skaters like Gilbertson, who took a whack in the corner tonight, listen mainly, knowing their place at the edge of things. McKechnie, the veteran, stretches back like an old scarred cat. You sense a hint of weariness in a world so familiar, the gloom of a mid-season slump, his place on the bus and his heat on his ancient legs. A loosened tooth he tests with the tip of his tongue. The last word left for him. "No contest," he says. The meanest son of a bitch he's ever seen was Pete Goegan. He'd put out your eye as soon as shake your hand. He'd pitchfork his mother. Nodding, we stare out the windows, watching stragglers leaving the stadium. One points out the idling, darkened bus with a shout and hurls himself against the chain-link fence. Half watching, some of the older guys mull over how you end up in the life you do. The younger ones, which side of the ice Goegan played and how they might measure up. And maybe where was the guy or two they knew who lost an eye. Then, intruding into the silence, an unexpected voice. Gilbertson. His words as soft and perfectly timed as one of his passes. "Put out your eye," he says. "The son of a bitch. You know, he'd only do that to me twice." There's a section of the book, and I'm just going to read you a couple of poems from that. Set in Newfoundland. Jack Adams. traded off Terry when his salary was getting too high. In those days, you know, something the book looks at as well, the exploitation of the players back in those days. The way it used to work in Detroit, Jack would get a lump sum of money, and then he would, you know, pay his team out of that. What it was left over, he got for himself. So these guys were getting practically nothing in those days. Terry got dumped off. His salary was too high. I mentioned Glenn Hall was coming behind in the system. So they went to Newfoundland to play some games to make some money. They were playing for $25 a game. Now, I mean, the Bruins going to Newfoundland would be like, you know, Manchester United coming to one of the smaller communities and playing a local team. It was just done for exhibition. I went to visit the goaltender who played against them. And one of the things that they would do is let the other team, to let them catch up. You know, they let them all take a penalty shot. And another thing they do is they switch goalies halfway through the game. Imagine a guy in a small community getting a chance to play with, you know, with a top team like that. And when I went to talk to him, it was great evening. And he was the first person that I did talk to, and he said something to me that didn't register right away. He said, "They put four past me real quick." And it wasn't until much later I thought, my Jesus, it was like that was 40 years ago, but he remembered it like it was yesterday. Now that's how strong the dream is in young people and not so young people, you know, to play in the NHL. So I'm going to read you two or three poems from that. The first one, Sawchuk is speaking, and he's met this goalie out of center ice. It's called Fair Trade. I skated to talk to their goalie at center ice. The game half done and the score about 20 to nothing. The guys put four past him real quick. The building's still buzzing over Mikkel and the move he makes on this guy at the net and how he had those two poor buggers working their tails off trying to catch him. Heads down, legs pumping like they're skating for their lives. It's only an exhibition game. But who can tell what dreams awaken in your head? The crowd was wild as they hit the blue line. Mikkel out in front with the pair of them gaining, the crowd gone crazy, driving them hard at girls who'd never give them a glance downtown, the bleacher teachers and Milbloss's wives, in a frenzy urging them on, when Mikkel reaches absently back with one hand, I knew this was coming, and tucks in the tail of his sweater. My eyes take in the goal pad, stitched and patched, the taped-up toes of his skates, the battered trapper where he's got the puck Mikkel puts past him, jerking him out of his jockstrap. He shakes his head like it's all a blur, what happened there. I could say, you need to see the shot before it leaves the stick, but he'd look at me as if I had two heads. I start hauling off my sweater instead and say, how'd you like to play goal for the Boston Bruins? Alarmed, he lifts an eyebrow, glancing around at the crowd and his bench, and his two guys hanging over the boards trying to catch their breath. Well, bye, he says, and I see he's thinking it over. I wouldn't say no, if you'd like to play for the Corner Brook All-Stars. And then the next poem, the one that follows that, this time it's the goaltender from Corner Brook speaking. Game's over. He's taken Sawchuk out ice fishing after they've had a brew at the local bars. And this touches on this whole question of, again, the dream. Nothing but moonlight here. Terry looks out at me, pointing just inside the post as I was next. That roused the boys for a joke or two about goalies together. I lumbered in like some old woods horse deep in snow or a man balled up with the weight of the world. I knew what the trouble was. Divided loyalties. I tried to blank out who's in goal with a chance to close the gap. Did I mention they put four past me real quick? Undressed me in front of everyone I know. After the game and half a dozen drinks, we went out onto my ice, two goalies going fishing in the dark. So where's the lake? He looks around, coming out of the woods. Nothing but moonlight here. Nothing but snow. You're standing on it, I said. I showed him how you feel with your line to the bottom. He sat, not saying much and catching less. But a hole in the ice at night is a dangerous thing. And he told me a thing or two about the life I wouldn't mention here. I was after rubbing places where I'd taken shots. surprising myself with some I stopped, and crazy things that started creeping into my head. Over a snow-covered lake, a moon can be mischievous. But slowly a chill crept into my bones, and more than once I thought about my wife, and how she'd come hammering back to bed in the cold and crush against my heat, and how she'd warm her hands between my legs, the way she liked to fall asleep, and my rabbit snares in the woods. I thought about those, and Mad Dog Lake, and up in the wind after birds with a friend, or coming on caribou tracks in an early snow. Yes, it was four they tucked in behind me, before the shine was even off the ice. And then I missed that open net he left for me, bounced it off the post with everybody looking on. Foolish to be so fine in goalie gear. Out on the lake that night, I get free of a lot of foolishness I wouldn't mention here. Ineptness and geography. I doubt there's many fine salvations where they hope. This is the last poem in Sawchuk's voice. Toward the end of his life, you know, the alcoholism was pretty much out of control. Family life was a mess. He had seven children. He was a very, very unhappy man. You know, I don't deal in this book with the death at the end. I'm not interested in what happened to him. What I'm interested in is why it happened, and that turned me back onto just the stresses and strains of 21 years of playing this game, this position, at this particular time. There's a poem called What I Liked About Bars. What I liked about bars was the neon invitation. The glow down the block on a bad night. A tramp's hieroglyphic on a likely gate. Was the taxi burbling off? Was the way you stamped off snow in the doorway careful not to give the wrong impression? Was what the place gave out of someone's dream? The photographs, the antlers gathering dust, the ship's barometer you tapped for luck, with the clatter of caps and the slam of cooler doors. With the little notes the girls stuck up for each other by the phone, and the way they had with regulars, the teasing, interrupted talk. With knowing they'd always be back to their ashtray under the bar, with knowing the route exactly to the can, with the mirrors, doubled bottles, those that ended up in the back, Aquavit and Metaxa, Galliano, long-necked and lethal, the bartender's best friend. What I liked about bars was the way they shoehorned you into the night. Someone you'd seen before sends over a drink. Tough night, Terry. Somewhere not far, a woman's voice, a woman's low, distracted laugh. You hear her murmur something, excusing herself. You wait to hear her voice behind you, or see her purse as it sags on the bar by your arm. What I liked was no one pressed you to look at a task or take a troubled daughter back to bed. You couldn't just go home, your head still rattling over the one you made at the end or didn't. Or something some bastard said from their bench, bloody polite, the way he gets under your skin. How could you think about riddles and hens and trains that could when you knew you couldn't? Some nights it hurt just to breathe. Then you had your assholes in the graves. So here I am again, looking down into an unfamiliar street. Some things don't change. This radiator's welcome heat, or how the snow begins, that sparse and aimless swirling past the light. And there's the purse again, collapsed on the floor like a daughter's indispensable animal tumbled off the bed. Are you leaving so soon? I hear her murmur into her pillows. A draft from an ill-fitting window stirs a mobile over her bed. Has it started snowing yet, she asks, but she won't wake up enough to hear, even if I answer. Thanks very much.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, round the mic. So.